Welcome to Changemaker with founder of Gypsy Tea and social entrepreneur Zina Muzyka.
This new podcast is to help you embrace change and experience amazing people and entrepreneurs. We're going to be sharing secrets, habits, and change-making abilities with you so that you can apply them to your life and make a life of your dreams.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
Hello, listeners. So happy to have you join us for another episode of Changemaker. Today, we are going to be examining how sudden, nearly tragic change can absolutely give you a certain level of determination, patience, and compassion in your life. We're with Alan Locus, founder and guiding teacher of the Community Meditation Center in New York City. When Alan Locus found himself trapped in the burning wreckage of a plane crash in Myanmar on Christmas Day 2012, it was his basic human instinct to do everything in his power to get himself and his wife out of the plane and survive. His new book, Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination, is Alan's engrossing and inspiring memoir of survival. Welcome to Changemaker, Alan.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Thank you. And so tell me what happened on Christmas Day 2012.
Well, it started out as an absolutely beautiful, wonderful day. We were up early because we were scheduled to be on an 8 a.m. flight from Mandalay to a little tiny town called Hiho, which is near Inle Lake, a real attraction for tourists. We boarded the plane at 8, went to the first available seats, which were a little bit more than halfway back on the left side of the plane. Full-size plane. It could seat 100. There were 71 altogether on the plane. We took off, and everything was as one would expect it to be. When we began to come down, things still seemed normal. And then we hit and began to spin around and turn, and the plane was shaking. And my wife immediately said, "We've crashed." I thought to myself, I didn't say it to her, of course, but I thought she was overreacting, that it was just a bad landing. But almost immediately, the plane began to fill with this very thick, black, noxious smoke. It turns out that what happened was officially pilot error. The pilot came in about a mile short of the runway, and as he came down, the wings of the plane sheared through heavy electrical cables. And on this type of plane, the fuel is carried in the wings. So when the wings went through these heavy cables, they sparked and the plane immediately burst into flame. Just as immediately there was chaos within the plane, people up and trying to push toward the front, for some reason I stood up and put my arms up and called out to everybody, "Just stay where you are, stay calm, it'll be okay, we'll all get out." But of course nobody listened, everybody just kept pushing toward the front. And at that point I just took my wife, put her in front of me, and we started to go toward the front, only nobody was moving. We were stuck in the plane, and we were now really being engulfed in this thick black smoke. And my wife said to me, I'll never make it out the front. I'm already choking. I looked to my left, and I saw that the emergency door must have popped open. I believe that's what happened on the impact of the crash. Only it was engulfed in flames. If you were going to get out that emergency door, you would have to jump through the flames. And I said to her, "That's our only choice. You're going out and you're just going to go right through and you'll be fine." I had, for a moment, an image in my mind of running a finger through a candle flame.
Yeah.
If you run it through quickly enough, you don't get hurt. And I said, "You're going right out." And I said, "Are you ready?" She said, "Yes." And I just gave her a push and she was right out. In retrospect, of course, I realized I had no idea what I was pushing her out into or how far down she was going to go, but there really seemed to be no choice at that point. My intention was to follow right after her, but as I started to move forward for myself to go through the door, I realized my foot was caught on something. I don't know what it was because I couldn't see. All I knew that was that I was then stuck and I was in the fire. Not surrounded by fire, but in it, and I was burning. I remember turning around and calling out for help, but nobody looked my way at all. Their concerns were getting out of the plane. The feelings at that moment were, clearly I was scared. I mean, I was terrified. But at the same time, I was also calm. I know that sounds perhaps contradictory, but what I mean by calm and terrified is that I was scared, but I was aware that I was scared.
Yeah.
And I knew that that fear and terror were feelings, but I couldn't concern myself with those feelings. My concern had to be free myself and get out. At that point, I have my only actual blank in memory. From trying to free myself, my next memory is actually landing on the ground, which was on my fours, on my knees and hands. My trauma therapist, who became an important part of my life afterwards, said that that blank spot in memory is kind of a gift of the benevolent brain, that you don't have to remember something that was so horrifying. But we work on it. We're trying to get back as much as we can. It doesn't scare me now to look back and try to recall. I've actually asked the two doctors who were most active in working on me afterwards if they could estimate how long I was in the fire. And they said it would be difficult to estimate. It might have been 45 seconds. It might have been 30 seconds. It might have been 60 seconds. But it was enough time to do a lot of damage. The story, just very briefly, was that at that point I was helped. My wife tried to pull me away from the plane. She was concerned that it would explode, which actually it did, but we were enough away from the plane at that point. We were helped up a slope into what I remember as being kind of an abandoned stone temple. There was essentially no medical care. A doctor did come. He told my wife, there's nothing to do. He can't possibly live through these injuries. And he left. He never came back. Fortunately, two young men and their wives from the American Embassy had heard about the crash. They inquired as to whether there were Americans on the plane. They were told no and they should go away. But fortunately, they were experienced and they didn't go away. They came, they found us. They worked really hard for hours and helped us get out of Myanmar, where we were flown to Bangkok, from Bangkok flown to Singapore, because the essential thing with serious burns is to get immediate attention. Infection is a serious problem. I had burns over one-third of my body, and those burns were classified, what they call today, full thickness. That used to be called third-degree burns. So through some of those burns, you could see right through to tendon and bone. It was serious. In Singapore, there was a good burn unit, and we met an extraordinary doctor, and even saying doctor is not enough to describe him. He was
a miracle worker.
He was a healer in the truest sense. We've remained good friends since. I mean, imagine, here's a doctor in Singapore who calls me and says, hi, how you doing? It's BK. I don't have a doctor in New York who does that. He was the first doctor, after my wife had heard from four or five doctors that I couldn't possibly survive. He said, no, I think he will do fine. I think he'll regain full function of his hands. My hands were really badly burned. Within, I guess, about a week, it was his view that they should try to get me to New York right at that time while I still had some of my own body strength.
Yeah.
And he was right. It was a very difficult move to set up. It had to be done in a medevac transport plane. My wife could not be on the plane, which was excruciating for her. She was also injured physically, 4 broken vertebrae among her injuries. Nevertheless, that was accomplished. I was flown to New York. She had come on a plane herself, greeted me at the airport, I'm told. I don't remember it. Upon arrival at the hospital, which was done very quickly, the first thing that she was told was, oh, sorry, I don't think he can possibly make it. So even here in New York, the prognosis was the same. These injuries were severe. But as you can tell...
You're still here.
I'm still here and having a good time.
Remarkable. I my biggest fear is plane crash. And I sweat out of my palms even when we hit big turbulence. And I'm always talking to pilots, okay, what happened there? And tell me exactly the science and tell me if we were at risk. Like I... And so to read that you've gone through something that most of us fear so much, but your background in mindfulness and Buddhism and meditation and all of that, I want to talk a little bit about how that built you to survive this when everybody was saying you couldn't, and how that has come into play now that you've been healing. It's been 3 years, only 3 years.
You look actually great. 2 years.
2 years. So it was, December 2012. So only 2 years. You look fantastic. You have an amazing presence about you. You're very much here.
I am here.
And so tell me a little bit how the meditation and the practice in your life really helped you through this immense,
stuff.
I'm speechless because I don't want to relate to it too much because I don't want to attract it to myself.
No.
But the meditation side, the strength that you emulate is really something that we can all learn from. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. You should also know that you're not alone. I don't even remember how many people have said to me, I lived their worst nightmare.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about flying that scares people.
Well, we don't have control.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the statistics are very, very much in our favor.
Absolutely.
It's difficult to truthfully answer how my years of practice that preceded this event played into it, how it helped me. I believe very definitely that meditation, contemplation, introspection were very significant. They're very much a part of my life. It's been more than 2 decades that I've practiced. Mm-hmm. But that I could say this aspect of practice or that aspect of practice would, I think, on a certain level be presumptuous. But there are pieces that I can put together through logic that make sense to me. As an example, today, researchers unanimously agree that stress is a killer.
Yes.
The statement has been made that they know of no illness that is not exacerbated by stress.
Mm-hmm.
The purpose of meditation at its root was not about stress reduction.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that those of us who meditate tend to experience less stress is, in a sense, a byproduct.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a very basic byproduct. I would say to someone having nothing to do with meditation, if you and I were to sit down together and just stop what we're doing, let's just sit here. We can look at each other. What if that makes you uncomfortable? We can close our eyes. And let's just sit here for 3 minutes. With nothing else to do. If you get really bored, why don't you see if you can follow the sensations of an in-breath and an out-breath.
Anapana.
Yeah, but you don't even have to do that. Just stop. Well, when I've done that with people, after 3 minutes, they say, wow, that was so great. And all they did was stop.
Yeah.
The stop they stop their busyness. They stop being a human doing, mm-hmm. and for a moment we're a human being. Mm-hmm. So that's a big factor. Now, if you expand that 3 minutes to 20 minutes, or as I do, let's say 45 minutes, plus periods of 5 minutes throughout the day, it will have its effect over time. I appear to be, to other people, calm. I feel that I am. I don't get really, you know, really crazy about things. But there's a good balance. You know, I don't live just in, oh, everything is cool. I'm just floating
but
along.
But you mentioned something. So when the crash happened and you were aware of the fact that you had crashed, but you were aware of your mind.
Yes. Well, as I said, it's a terrifying situation. Mm-hmm. You know, fire can be a great friend. Fire can also be an enemy. And at that moment, I had to view it as an enemy. I needed to get out of it. Mm-hmm. So it was both terrifying, and yet I was thinking clearly. I was thinking clearly enough to get my wife out, mm-hmm. to try to help others. And then I was stuck, and I knew I had to get out. Whatever I had to do to get out, I did. So one of the things that I think is misunderstood about meditation and that state of calm, the state of equanimity, is that it's passive. It's not necessarily passive at all. It can be
very active.
It's the
hardest work I've ever done.
Yeah. Oh, it is. It's challenging. I remember reading Houston Smith, who was one of our great teachers in world religions. When he wrote his book, The World's Religions, he didn't just study religions, he went and lived them 2 or 3 years at a time. When he went to a Buddhist monastery and got himself admitted, the monk said, all right, I will go and see that we have a room prepared for you. You just sit here for a few minutes and close your eyes and just watch your breath for a couple of minutes. And Houston Smith said, that was the hardest thing I ever had to do. And it's not that the act is difficult. It's that we don't do it.
Exactly.
We never do that. Mind is very active. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't mean there's something wrong with the mind. It means that is the nature of mind.
Absolutely.
Mind has thoughts arising, feelings, sensations. We usually bypass that bare experience, the bare experience of a thought, for instance, that arises. The thought might be, I have a meeting today. Mm-hmm. And then we go immediately to, oh, and that meeting is with Bob, and he's such a pain in the butt.
You go into tactics.
Every time I have a meeting with him, it ruins my day. I can't even eat lunch. I get angry when I get home. All of that we call an add-on, mm-hmm. the writing of a story. Mm-hmm. The bare experience is there's going to be a meeting. Mm-hmm. And in the practice of meditation, we learn to just be with that bare experience. If an add-on arises, we're aware of it. It's not that there's something wrong with additional thoughts. If we can be aware of them, that kind of awareness, with other factors brought to it, for instance, a factor of good intention, or what we call skillful intention, becomes the practice of mindfulness.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
You're listening to Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
Well, and let's talk, because you and I practice the same form of meditation, mm-hmm. Vipassana, and so let's talk about in the insight aspect of it. So I always say, you know, when the thought arises, say thinking. When the sensation of my knee hurts, say hurting. But you don't attach to the word, you keep moving.
That's right.
And you don't build the story, because then the story sets you off on the path. You name it and you move on. You name it and you move on. And Goenka, I think what struck me most in my first 10-day sit was the fact that I felt that most of my life was running toward pleasure and running away from pain. So I was in constant transit, and I was never actually really present. So can you talk a little bit about insight meditation and explain it to our listeners?
Sure. What you just described, the desire for pleasure, the aversion to that which is unpleasant, those are the first two of what are called hindrances, attraction and aversion. And again, it doesn't mean that there's something wrong with attraction. You know, if it wasn't for attraction, the human race wouldn't exist anymore. And aversion is necessary because you don't want to be standing in a fire. It's when we get attached to attraction and cling and grasp. In the Buddhist tradition, that's actually described as the core of what causes our suffering. And when you think about it, that sounds simplistic on a certain level. But if you follow that through, and let's take a very dramatic example and say, well, what if my loved one passes away? And I really am clinging and I'm grasping and I'm grieving. Well, grieving is healthy and natural. But if you look at what that grieving is about, it's not really about the fact that someone has died. We know that everyone dies. The grief is about, I didn't want him to die. I want him here with me. So that's a form of clinging, but it's very natural. There's nothing wrong with that at all. And it helps if we can bring awareness to that, you know, that I am so sad because I really miss Jane, and I really want her to still be here. Aversion works the same way, that idea of pushing away what is unpleasant, needing to end immediately any sensation of physical pain. You know, we have this enormous market of painkillers.
Painkiller.
Right. Yeah. And we have been inundated with the message that get these painkillers immediately.
Pain is bad.
Yeah. Pain is the enemy. Mm-hmm. And actually, pain isn't an enemy at all. Pain can be life-saving.
Let's talk about pain.
Ah, very difficult subject.
Let's talk about pain. Yeah, I mean, you have obviously undergone an enormous amount of physical pain with your when you were going through this. What did the meditation work? Did the naming the pain? How do you move on from pain when it's incessant?
Notice how it's even difficult to formulate a question about pain. Very, very difficult subject. Pain is compelling. There's no way around it. Chronic pain is going to get to you. And we don't have answers. We certainly don't have easy answers. At a certain point, medication is probably the best thing to do. But it's not necessarily the first thing that we should do. I think it's very helpful to understand the nature of pain. Pain is simply a word. It's a word that we use so that we can communicate about a series of unpleasant sensations.
Yes.
Now, I know that sounds sugarcoating something
no,
that
pain
hurts
is a sensation like,
oh. like...
Yeah, but you went through enormous pain, and I'm sure you had to be on painkillers because you can't grow back your skin without an enormous amount of pain, I'm sure.
Well, doctors felt that I had to, so I was for a while, but whenever I could be off of them, I was off of them. Now, there is one thing about burns that go so deep. Initially, there's actually less pain than a simple cut that you'd experience in the kitchen. Because when the burn goes so deep, it goes through the nerve endings.
Oh.
And they don't participate. Now, I'm not saying there's no pain. There is. But where the pain really becomes intense is when and if you're fortunate enough that those nerve endings regenerate.
Oh.
The regeneration of nerves is a painful process. But, you know, in my case, I was so joyful that these nerves were regenerating that, I know this sounds crazy, but some of this was actually taught to me by a trauma therapist. That I could look at my hands, my legs were badly burned, and just thank them. thank them for these nerves regenerating. And yes, I felt really awkward speaking to my hands. I did it silently. And if I did it out loud, I made sure no one was around. You know, there's an old line that says, if a person speaks to God, he's holy. If God speaks to the man, he's psychotic. So I wanted to make sure I was viewed as saying, there was a period, by the way, this is not about physical pain, but it was very difficult for my family. When I went through ICU psychosis, and I was batty. I mean, I was really nuts. And they were concerned, you know, will I ever come out of that? But just tangent for a moment, I was having a great time. I had a background in the theater. I was a singer and actor. I did Broadway shows, etc. And I was singing full voice, and I was proclaiming great monologues, be they Shakespearean or wherever I had learned them, or I made up my own. And apparently I was in good voice. I was getting very good reviews from the other patients and the staff. So I was okay with it, but it was a frightening experience for those around me, nor could doctors assure my wife that I would come out of it.
Interesting.
ICU psychosis, if you're in ICU for a period of time, has its issues.
Interesting.
I also, after surviving Myanmar, surviving Bangkok, surviving Singapore, it was in New York City that I developed sepsis. And sepsis, as you probably know, is very dangerous, kills millions of people each year. It's an infection of the blood. It's very difficult to deal with. Fortunately, within a few days and some very uncomfortable medication, I passed through it.
Wow.
So just to go back to physical pain for a moment, because I'm asked about it so often and I feel so helpless when I am. The nature of pain, we now know, is a series of vibrations.
Yeah.
Scientists tell us that everything is vibrating, confirming something that the Buddha taught 2,500 years ago, which is that everything is changing in every moment, the characteristic that he referred to as impermanence. So rather than immediately being caught up in, oh, this pain is awful, mm-hmm. we can learn to actually look at what the body is experiencing. Mm-hmm. There are sensations. What do they feel like? Well, if we look carefully, which means we have to clear the panic out of our mind, mm-hmm. and what we'll see is that there is movement going on. What we call a constant stabbing pain, for as an example, is not constant. It's moving. It may be moving rapidly so that it feels to us as if it's constant, but it is moving. We can also inquire within ourselves, is this a sharp pain? Is it a dull ache? Do I feel it vibrating? Do I feel it quivering? Does it seem to have a color about it?
Mm-hmm.
What am I actually feeling, and where exactly am I feeling it? Mm-hmm. Point to where I am feeling this.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you might say legitimately, well, that's all well and good, but it still really hurts. Sure, pain is pain. And what we're really looking to do is see if we can change our relationship to those sensations.
Absolutely.
The sensations are there. They're very real. You're not fooling yourself. And certainly we're not trying to practice denial, mm-hmm. which is unhealthy.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about awareness, insight, mindfulness, but not denial.
Yeah.
So we become aware and we say, okay, this pain is such and such. Now, when I've done this, there are many times when that pain eases.
Agreed.
There are many times when it doesn't.
Yeah.
And there can be times when it's time for some aspirin-like
mm-hmm.
product,
mm-hmm.
or with the injuries that I had, maybe something mm-hmm. a little heftier than that. But I don't think we have to run to the painkiller right away.
Yeah.
As soon as I could get off of them, I did, and it wasn't awful.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm not saying there weren't periods that were very difficult. There were.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
This is Changemaker with Zina Muzyka.
How has this changed you?
Well, often people ask me how has it changed my teaching, or has it changed my teaching? And, you know, I'm going to say, no, I don't think it's changed my teaching, other than occasionally I'll refer back to an experience related to this event. I wonder if people hear me differently. You know, I'm no longer someone who is sharing the words of great teachers from the past. I'm somebody who has been in the fire with you and understands on a much deeper level the divorce that you're going through, the financial loss that you're going through, the death of a loved one, the diagnosis that you just got from the doctor. It's not theory and philosophy with me anymore. And frankly, before this, I was never ill. I would get a cold every 10 years. And then I would get really arrogant about it. What's this cold doing in my body, you know? And interestingly enough, even since the accident, no illnesses, lots of injury stuff to deal with, but no illnesses. How it has changed me. Sometimes I say to people, you know what the best moment in my life ever has been? This moment right now.
Yeah.
With you, Zina, right now. With you right here.
Absolutely.
Because this is the moment.
This is all we've got.
Everything before this is memory. And now the scientists are telling us memory is really inaccurate and becomes inaccurate immediately afterwards. And on the other end of this moment is projection.
Yeah.
What may happen. So even when we speak about fear, it's always fear of what we think is going to happen. Fear of being in a plane crash? You haven't been in one. You're not in one right now, right? I've been in one, but I don't have a fear of the next one.
Have you flown?
I have flown. Well, of course, at my initial flights, I wasn't conscious.
Yes.
I had signed a teaching agreement in Seattle long before the accident, and I decided I wanted to do it. I wanted to go to Seattle and do it. So we went out and had a great time. I have flown to Hawaii, which was a nice long flight, flown in between the islands.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable. My wife is not as comfortable when we're landing, which is understandable.
Yeah.
She's working on it.
Yeah.
We have some big flying plans coming up to Africa with small flights in between. I think many times I will actually stop and say to myself, this is great right now.
Yeah.
And it might be nothing. I mean, just walking on the street.
Absolutely.
The sun is shining. It's raining. Doesn't make any difference.
The sense of gratitude to have this life.
Yeah, I wasn't supposed to have this. You know, these doctors are not fools. We can say, well, one doctor off in some small country, maybe he's not well-trained or something. But no, not when you get to Singapore and you get to New York City and, you know, I had some of the greatest doctors in the world here in New York. You know, they know what they're talking about. So something happened, and even though I went through an unfortunate experience, I view myself as incredibly fortunate. Whatever time I have now, 5 more minutes, 20 more years, it is like a gift. I don't view it as destiny. I don't put pressure on myself saying you were given this extra gift of time, therefore you must
go out and save the world.
Right, save the world, do something profound. No, I'd rather help an elderly person in the street with the shopping bags that they're carrying. I guess I'm kind of an elderly person. Well, I hadn't thought about that. Let's say someone in my age category or older. That's something. I've never felt old, and I still don't feel old.
Yeah.
Maybe at some point I will be fortunate enough to feel old. No, I think it's about what we do in these moments. The other day in an interview, someone said to me, he said, I know this is a broad question, but what do you think is the meaning of life? And I said, I don't know that there is innately a meaning to life, but I think that if there's going to be any meaning, we create that meaning for ourselves. We make a meaningful life. For a long time, I've tried to do that. Probably in my early days in the theater, it was all about ego and trying to get the next job. And I'm in a Broadway show. Aren't I great? and then, you know, maybe if you're fortunate enough and you find a good therapist and you find a good meditation teacher, you grow up a little bit. And, you know, as you mentioned before, it becomes not so much about seeking pleasure. Pleasure is great, but it's momentary. It's short term.
Yeah.
Trying to do the work that leads us to a sense of abiding happiness is quite different. That requires eliminating the ways in which we cause ourselves and others unhappiness.
Absolutely. How has this changed your relationship with your wife?
Well, we always had a great relationship, very fortunate. We spend a lot of time together. We work together. But it certainly has deepened it.
Yeah.
There's no question that she's my hero. Mm. While everybody else was saying I wouldn't live, she would not buy that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a story that some of our friends like to repeat. There was a doctor, I think it was in Bangkok. I barely heard a piece of the conversation, but this doctor said to my wife that there's no way this man can live. And my wife said to him, "You don't know this man." And later I thought to myself, no, the answer there really is he didn't know that woman. I was not going to die on her watch. She did incredible things. And you know, I didn't really fully understand. I probably will never fully understand, but I didn't understand at the level I do now until maybe 2 months ago. I was doing a TV spot, and before we did it, they asked if I had any pictures of me after the accident, right after the accident. I knew there were pictures, but I had never seen them.
Oh.
So I asked to see them, and what I saw was astonishing. I thought it was interesting that I didn't get emotionally upset, but I was astonished at what I saw. And for the first time, I realized why doctors were saying I wouldn't live.
Mm.
And then I saw two additional pictures taken in Singapore, and I said, whoa, the person in these pictures was really injured. It was rather amazing that he lived. And my wife was looking at this every moment of every day. I was looking at one isolated moment in a photograph.
Yeah.
And she looked at this every day, and she didn't quit. She
Amazing.
Never quit.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Well, for our listeners, the book is Through the Flames, Overcoming Disaster Through Compassion, Patience, and Determination. Our guest today is Alan Locus. This book is not only beautiful, but I haven't read the whole thing yet, and I was saying I'm going to read it on the plane ride home, and Alan said, "You are," and then I thought twice. But you know, it goes through. Not only is it memoir, it's got a really beautiful. You know, you're talking about the miraculous body, the people who helped you, the work, learning to receive, moving through transitions, pain, determination, patience. And then you go into the path, meditation and mindfulness, generosity, effort. I think that, you know, this book is something that will be a reference book for a lot of people because, you know, we may not survive plane crashes every day of our lives, but we go through many versions of it. And I
Absolutely.
Think that this is going to be a book that's going to be a great reference point for many. So tell us how we can find more about you, your website, any of that.
I do have a website. It's alanlocus.com, alanlocos.com. The book is available at all the usual sources, Amazon, Barnes & Noble. And I always like to support our indie bookstores.
Absolutely. They're, get out there and buy it from the independent booksellers. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And you'll be on tour.
I will.
And we will definitely have to do a follow-up interview to see how this continues to change. And I'd like to do one interview just with you teaching a meditation, if that's okay.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
It would be wonderful. And once again, this is Changemaker with Zena Muzyka. I'm your host. And today's guest was Alan Locus, the author of Through the Flames. Thank you so much for joining us today, and I hope that you take this inspiration, go get the book, and learn the lessons that Alan has learned and emulated so beautifully through this experience. And thank you. And for more about me, you can go to Twitter. I have a handle from my old tea days called @mistressoftea. My Facebook is /ZHENA, Zena. I am on LinkedIn, and I am also on Instagram @Zena1. And for any of you who know who took @Zena on Instagram, I've been trying to get a hold of that person because they have no posts and they hijacked my name. So I would love to have @Zena, but for now, I have @Zena1. Contact me there and let's carry on the conversation.